Leviticus chapter 9. This is a very unique Torah portion that we are in. It has, I noticed three things here that are very confusing in this Torah portion. And in fact, I see Moses confused. I see Nadab and Abihu definitely confused. I see Aaron maybe a bit confused. And then there's a little confusion to go around for everybody in this portion. But the portion opens up with this wonderful event that Ben described during the prayer service, where the high priest Aaron and his four sons, they come and they basically inaugurate the tabernacle, and they bring the first sacrifices. And then it says in verse 22, Aaron raised his hands toward the people and blessed them. Then he descended from having performed the sin offering, the elevation offering, the peace offering. Moses and Aaron came to the tent of meeting, and they went out and they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord, the glory of Adonai, appeared to the entire people. Now remember back in Exodus, around, I think it's chapter 32, 34, Aaron, and Nadab and Abihu, 70 of the elders, they all went up to the top of Mount Sinai, and they beheld God's glory, God's presence there. But now God reveals his glory to all the people there from the tabernacle. And not only that, but verse 24, a fire went forth from before Adonai and consumed upon the altar the elevation offering and the fats. The people saw and sang glad song and fell upon their faces. What a wonderful day. But then for some odd reason, Nadab and Abihu get it into their heads to take fire on their incense burners and take it in before the Lord. And it just tells us it's an alien fire. Apparently it wasn't fire that came from the altar out in the courtyard, because the altar in the courtyard, only that fire was to be used to burn incense inside the holy place. So maybe they brought fire from some other location or just started a new one. And then why were they bringing incense at all on their censers? There's no commandment to do that. And then why are they each bringing their own? And the question is, was it because they brought this weird fire that wasn't from the altar? Was it because they were drunk? Because after this event where they bring their fire in and they get struck dead, it says, don't let the priests be drinking wine when they have to serve. Which brings up an interesting point. Yeshua is our high priest, isn't he? And after at his death, there at the last Passover Seder, when it comes to the last cup of the meal, he says, I will not drink this cup with you until I drink it with you in my Father's kingdom. Because his role as high priest began at that point when his blood had been shed, and he had appeared and he made a way for us by his own blood into the Holy of Holies of the temple made without hands. You see, Aaron was a high priest on earth, but Yeshua is a high priest in the heavenlies. Aaron was a high priest for that particular place, the tabernacle on earth. Yeshua is the high priest, the temple in heaven. Aaron was a high priest just for a period of time, for that generation. But Yeshua is a high priest for eternity, for all time before and after. You see? So Aaron is a picture, a little picture, a miniature photograph, if you will, of the reality of who Yeshua is and what he does. But I'm digressing here. So were they drunk? Did they go into the Holy of Holies? That's another theory. Or did they just go in with the wrong spirit? Did they go in with a spirit of pride? Yes, we are sons of the high priest. We can go in, and those other nincompoops out there, they can't go in, but we can. Was it the wrong spirit? We don't know. We're not really given the complete answer of what they were thinking or what exactly it is they did. And then you go on a bit further in chapter 10, and we notice here that Aaron and his other remaining sons, they don't eat the sin offering that was made. The commandment is for the high priest and his family to eat the sin offering. But Moses finds out that they burnt the sin offering. They burnt the goat entirely. And Moses is terribly upset because he's thinking, okay, we've lost two priests today because they goofed. Are we going to lose three more? Then where do we go? The whole priesthood's wiped out in 24 hours because they have not obeyed the Torah. And so he goes and he questions Aaron's sons, but then Aaron steps forward and explains his actions. And then it says it was good in Moses' eyes. He said, okay, all right, I understand why you did what you did. But even that whole episode, a bit confusing. And Moses, he's confused. What do we do? What's going on? And then you come to chapter 11. You think, finally, here's something that's very easy to understand because it's describing what animals you can eat and what animals you can't eat. It starts with land animals. Land animals have to have a split hoof, chew the cud, you can eat them. They don't have a split hoof and don't chew the cud, they don't have those two signs, they're an abomination. Don't you dare eat them. They're not even food. When it comes to fish, scales, fins. Those are the two things to look for. No scales or no fins. They have to have both. If you have both of them, you can eat them. But if they lack one or the other or both, you can't. Snakes you can't eat. They got scales. They have no fins. Catfish you can't eat. They've got fins but no scales. Okay? So it's very simple. And then it comes to the birds. And now there's confusion again. Because for the birds, he doesn't give principles. He doesn't say, watch for this and this. You can eat them. If they don't have this or this, then you can't. He just names the birds they're allowed to eat. And he names the birds they're not allowed to eat. And we have no idea what those birds are today. We don't know what those Hebrew words mean anymore. So once again, confusion. And then he keeps talking about bugs with four legs. Most bugs I know have six. And so all of a sudden, clarity begins to kind of go into this gray area. What do we do? And yet, this Torah portion, Shemini, is the 26th Torah portion in the Torah. Now, what's the significance of 26? It's the number of God's name. And we've spoken about that many times. The Yud Hey Vav Hey equals 26. We've looked at how significant the number 26 is in mathematics and science and geometry and in Torah. It's an incredible and an amazing number. And this is Torah portion number 26, the heart of the Torah. I have an overhead I've made up. I want you to pay close attention because you may think, well, this is just interesting stuff Grant's sharing with us, and I hope you do find it interesting, but there's a deep spiritual significance to what I'm about to show you. If you were to count all the letters in the Torah, and let's say one person started with Genesis 1:1, and one person started with the last letter of Deuteronomy, and you began to count, one counting forward and one counting backwards, you'd eventually come to a letter that stands at the very center of the Torah. It's found in our Torah portion. And it's found in Leviticus 11, verse 42, the center letter of the Torah. And if you look at 11:42, it says there, everything that creeps on its belly and everything that walks on four legs, up to those with numerous legs among all the teeming things that teem upon the earth, you may not eat them, for they are an abomination. The word belly in Hebrew is the word gachon, gachon. And if you'll notice, in the word gachon, the third letter, which is a vav, we count from the right, there's gimel, chet, vav. You'll notice it's oversized. That letter is the center letter of the Torah. And the center letter of the Torah appears in the word belly, because this is the belly of the Torah. So everything to the right of that vav is in the first half of the Torah. Everything to the left of that vav is in the second half of the Torah. And that vav stands square in the middle. But the Torah is also made up of words. And again, you start counting, and someone counts starting with Genesis, counting the words in the Torah, and someone starts in Deuteronomy, counting backwards the words of the Torah. You come to the middle two words. There's an even number of words in the Torah, and the two middle words are also found in our Torah portion. And they are in chapter 10, verse 6. I'm sorry, 16. Correct that on the overhead. It's verse 16, not 6. And the two middle words of the Torah are Darosh Darash. He diligently searched, or literally, it's a searching he searched. The two words are identical. Dalet resh shin, dalet resh shin. The first word, derosh, belongs to the first half of the Torah. The second word, darash, belongs to the second half of the Torah, if you're counting words, that is, instead of just letters. And it's found in the verse where we discussed Aaron, you know, and he burnt the sacrifice instead of eating it. And it says, Moses drosh drosh. He inquired insistently about the he-goat as an offering. So the middle two words of the Torah are found in Torah portion number 26, the one we are reading tonight. Well, then it makes me wonder, where is the middle verse of the Torah? Now, there's a little controversy about this. There's no controversy about the number of words or the number of letters, but verses are a little more controversial because there's no punctuation in the Torah. And so some people might say, well, this statement here is actually two verses. Another person might say, no, this statement is actually one long verse. So there's been some controversy, but finally, quite some time ago, the sages agreed that there are, and let me give you the number, 5,845 verses in the Torah. And the middle verse is found, guess which Torah portion? Shemini, right? Nope. Sorry, it's the one before. Back up to chapter 8. To chapter 8 and verse 8. And this is the verse. He placed the breastplate upon him, and in the breastplate he placed the Urim and the Tumim, which means the lights and perfections. We don't know exactly what they were. Some say it was inside this pocket and behind the breastplate. There was a pocket there, and there were two stones. And these two stones were taken out, and they would glow to give you a yes or a no answer. Some say it was a piece of parchment with God's name written on it that was tucked in there. And then when people went to inquire of the high priest, a matter they couldn't fathom, that lights or letters on the breastplate, because the names of Israel were engraved there, right? And the letters would glow in a certain order, and you would read the letters, it would spell out words for you. We don't know, but somehow we know there are several times when there was a matter that we needed to know what God was going to say. We needed to know what God's will was. And so they would consult the Urim and the Tumim, and they would get their answer, and the answer is always exactly right. So the middle verse of the Torah, he placed the breastplate upon the he placed the breastplate upon him, and in the breastplate he placed the Urim and the Tumim. The middle letter, the middle words, the middle verse. Now, that's the trivia. Now let's get to the deep spiritual insight that this brings us. If we take these according to the letter, the word, and the verse, you notice we work backwards from Leviticus 11, Leviticus 10, Leviticus 8. And the word belly, gakon, appeared in a verse that dealt with what? Creeping things, things that creep on their belly, you know, down in the dirt, down in the earth. Things are abominable, right? It's talking about a very negative, earthy thing. Something you do not eat is an abomination to you. And yet over here, the middle verse talks about putting the breastplate on the chest of the high priest. So I guess you could say on the gachon of the high priest, upon his belly, upon his chest. And in them you put the lights and the perfections. Here we move to the other end of the spectrum. There was no one on earth who had a higher position, a higher calling, than one who fulfills the role of the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest. And the Urim and Tumim begin with Aleph and Tav, respectively, the first and last letter of the alphabet, kind of like the Alpha and the Omega, so to speak. So we're talking about crawling insects to the high priest. And here we find the word gachon, belly, but here we find a breastplate that bears the names of the children of Israel that the high priest would wear as he appears before God in the tabernacle. And in the middle, in between, in chapter 10, we find the two middle words of the Torah. And the two words are the same. Drosh, drosh. They're pronounced differently, but spelled exactly the same. The Torah scrolls are identical. Searching, searching. Searching, searching. Here's a lesson for you. Let's take the verses in chronological order. Let's start with 8. It starts with something utterly spiritual, the high priest. And then as you move into chapter 10, Darosh Darosh, it has to do with the soul, diligently seeking. And then finally in chapter 11, it ends with the body, talking about what we can eat and what we can't eat, what we can put in our bodies and what God says do not put in your bodies. And here's the lesson for us. Listen carefully to this. Some people start with the belly and they never make it to the high priest. They are so caught up in the details of the rules of the Torah and the commandments that the Torah becomes nothing more than a rule book to them. It becomes nothing more than a tree of knowledge of good and evil. And everything has to do with the dirt and with the physical, what I'm allowed to do, what I'm not allowed to do, what's good, what's bad. And yet at the opposite end of the spectrum, what comes first is the spirit. The high priest, clean, holy, perfectly formed, coming before God. Wow. Unique. There's a gazillion bugs on the ground, but there's only one high priest. And you notice the order in which God gives them. We study the high priest first. Then we can finish up with the bugs. But some people who start with the bugs never make it to the high priest. And Ben talked about the zeal of the Torah movement and about Messianic Judaism, and I applaud that zeal. But I see that zeal many times misapplied. And people get caught up in when they can work and when they can rest, when the Moedim are, what they can eat and what they can't eat. And all it is do's and don'ts. Now those do's and don'ts are all important. They're all important. But there's something that comes first. Get a healthy picture of God. Develop a healthy relationship with God. Get the big picture of who God is, who you are, of His love for you, the security you have in Him. Get the big picture. Then you can deal with bugs. And you see, in the middle, we've got Darosh Darosh. One to the right, for the first half of the Torah, and the others in the second half of the Torah. If we search out the spiritual and the invisible, then we can accurately search out the physical and the revealed. We need to search out the hidden, search out the revealed. Search out the spiritual, search out the physical. Because people who do one or the other, they over-spiritualize the word, they don't think the commandments need to be obeyed, they're stunted in their growth. Other people just see the Bible as a book of do's and don'ts, stunted in their growth. They never see the light. They never see that as a tree of life. See, this is what's so amazing to me. Adam and Eve were commanded, do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They were freed from the tree of life. But somehow they thought that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil had something to offer, the tree of life didn't. Well, it did have something to offer. Separation from God, death, confusion, accusation, it had lots of things to offer the tree of life didn't have. And so they ate of the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And what was the result? Confusion and contention. What in the world makes you think that just studying the Torah as a rule book will lead to anything else than confusion and contention? There's no generation in the history of man that was more caught up in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil than the generation to which Yeshua came. And they strained out gnats. Oh, they could spot a gnat a mile away, but they were eating camels wholesale, weren't they? Swallowing them down. Missing the big picture because they were burying the dust looking for little gnats in their soup and swallowing camels. Now, one's just as unclean as the other. I don't want to eat gnats either. And I applaud you if you're straining out gnats. I don't applaud you if you're at the same time swallowing camels. I'm not talking about the cigarette, by the way. So here was a generation that definitely knew the letters of the scripture, but they missed the big picture. They missed the big picture. And so when the word, the Torah made flesh, comes and dwells among them, what do? away with this man. And they execute him as a criminal. And they even have to trump up charges against him to do it. You'll never truly recognize Messiah by treating the Torah as a rule book. But learning of Messiah and his life, the rules begin to come natural. They take their natural place in due course. That's work on the spirit and the soul. Drash, drosh, drosh. Let's search out everything. And then the body last. And it will take its proper place. But you put the body first. Well, remember how the Torah was given, how the Ten Commandments were given? I love that. I know I keep repeating it, and I'll repeat it the day I die. When God gave the stones of the Ten Commandments to Moses, the tradition says that the letters were carved and went all the way through the stone and out the backside. They went all the way through. So you had stone there, something earthy. But the words themselves were light, because when you held them up, it was the light that spoke to you, not the stone. The stone just simply helped define the light. But the stone was not the light. So how do you approach Torah? As tablets of stone or the light of God's glory? Which is it to you? If you approach them as dead stone, then you're just, it's a rule book. It's do's and don'ts. If you see the light of God's glory, the do's and don'ts, they'll definitely take care of themselves. They'll fall in their proper relation. No one was more perfect than Yeshua. I didn't see him going around condemning everybody who wasn't perfect. The only ones he condemned were the hypocrites. Those are the only ones he really, truly chewed out. Yes, Dia. And that's well put. We bind ourselves with our hearts together. See, the things that connects us is not that we agree on the do's and don'ts. One of the things I love about this place, we don't agree on the do's and don'ts. We had a neat discussion last night about whether we should eat gummy bears or not, because they have gelatin, and gelatin's made from hooves. Sometimes those hooves come from pigs. And so, do you eat them or not eat them? Well, we disagree. But our hearts are one. You see? They love me, they give me grace. And I love them, I give them grace. I'm not going to tell you which ones eat the gummy bears and which ones don't. It's none of your business. But we can have all kinds of things where when it comes down to the rules, you have a little bit of your personality interprets them a bit different. This is what I love about gray areas. We were talking about this last night. Gray areas demand that we love one another. Because what you fill the gray area with is love. Okay? And God purposely put gray areas in his word. And it drives me nuts. Because that means I have to love you if you don't see things the way I do. Because to me it's not gray. But then again, I have to be honest to say there are some areas that are gray. You understand? Some things are very black and white. But there are some areas when it comes to the particulars aren't quite as black and white. So there's this wideness in God's mercy. There's this gray area that we fill with love. We fill with love. I want you to turn to Proverbs chapter 3 for a moment. I'm going to read this passage that is quoted when Ben was lifting the Torah at the end of the Torah service. There it says, it's a tree of life to those who grasp it, and all its supporters are praiseworthy. It's in Proverbs chapter 3, but I'd like us to start in verse 13. And in your own life, in your own application of Torah to your life, ask yourself, is this what Torah looks like in my life, in your life? Proverbs 3:13, how blessed is the man who finds chokhmah, wisdom, and the man who gains bina, understanding. How blessed. Now, first of all, with all of your Torah observance, do people look at you and say, how blessed, how understanding? Or do they say, yuck, I don't like that? What do they say? Are you making the light of God attractive to others? Or are you eclipsing the light of God with your own display of your obedience? Let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works. Not let your works so shine on men they may see your light. But let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works and give you all the glory? No, give glory to your Father in heaven. When you are in tune with Torah, spirit, soul, and body, you become transparent. You kind of get out of the way. Because you see, your life becomes aligned with Him. And the light can show through the holes. You know what I'm saying? But anyways, how blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For her, referring to kokhmah, kokhmah is a feminine word. And a kokhmah, wisdom, is through Proverbs always symbolized by a woman. For her profit is better than the profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire. Now think of all the things you desire. A raise, a better house, smaller body, car. What is it you desire? Well, whatever it is, nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Remember, right is spiritual, left is always physical. Her ways are pleasant ways. Does your life of living Torah, is it pleasant to others, or is it a reproach? All her paths are peace. Does your Torah observant build bridges with others, or does it destroy them? She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. My fear is this. If you take hold of a rule book, you will not find life. But you take hold of the Torah, which is spiritual, Paul tells us, then you will take hold of life. It's a tree of life. And happy are all who hold her fast. Happy. Do you know, I wish I knew the reference off the top of my head. There's at least one place in the scriptures I know of where it refers to the blessed God, to God as the blessed God. Remember, the word blessed, Ashrei, means happy, because that's the word used, Ashrei. The happy God. You ever think God is a happy God? He's not a God of wrath. Oh, he's capable of wrath, but wrath is not what earmarks his personality. His wrath endures but a moment, the sitter says. Endures but a moment. His wrath is a very temporary thing. Now, if you're not capable of wrath, then there's something stunted in your life, because everyone should be wrathful sometime or other. Sometimes wrath is demanded, and even in Yeshua's life, we see an occasion or two where he was wrathful. But those were definitely the exceptions. He was a happy person. He was a person of peace, kind and gentle. Well, he's capable of wrath. You see, so I hope people don't look at me and say, Grant's a wrathful person. So I hope that doesn't earmark my character. But I'll tell you right now, Grant is capable of wrath. I just hope it's at the right time, to the right degree, and to the right duration. Okay? So is God a wrathful God? No, he's a happy God, capable of wrath at the right time. But anyways, happy are all who hold her fast. Verse 19, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps are broken up and the skies dripped with dew. Very interesting. Kokhmah, bina, and da'at. Three Hebrew words. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Says by kokhmah the earth was founded, by bina he steps the heavens. You know what connects the two? Knowledge, da'at. It's the blend of the two. His knowledge, the deeps are broken up and the skies drip with dew. The deeps are broken up, the water comes up. and the heavens bring dew down. You see what's happening? Da'at connects wisdom and understanding together. My son, let them not vanish from your sight. Keep sound the wisdom and discretion. So they will be what? Life to your soul. And what? An adornment to your neck. Something attractive. You know, when I see someone who claims to be Torah observant, the first thing I ask myself, is their life attractive or not? And just for my own puny, you know, perceptions, if it's attractive, then I think they really get Torah. It's a tree of life. It's something beautiful. But you know, their lives are not attractive, so I think they don't get it. It's a tree of knowledge of good and evil to them. It's a rule book. I want everyone to ask themselves, which one are you? Which one are you moving towards? And do you hear me saying that we should not keep the commandments, that we should not be careful and attentive to the commandments? Do you hear me saying that? I hope not. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, let's do things in order. Let's definitely see Yeshua as our high priest, get the big picture of what's going on here, and then we can deal with the earthly things much more, much better. When we have the lights and the completions, the tuning, the perfections, then we can deal with bugs and pigs and shrimp and all that sort of thing much more effectively. I got on this jag this past week or so. I've been reading the book, so you can blame Moshe M. Eisman for this tangent I've gotten off to. He's starting to become one of my favorite Jewish writers. And this book's called Worlds Beneath the Word. And I picked it up and started reading it because it comments on several of the verses from Perkei Avot. We read several of them last week and again this evening in the prayer service. And there's one of these Mishnahs, that's what they call a verse, one of these Mishnahs that just really jumped out at me. We read it this evening, and it's in Perkei Avot, it's in chapter 2, it's Mishnah number 6. It's in six parts, so what I would like us to do is go through these. This is a passage that is attributed to Hillel, who is the teacher of Gamaliel, who is the teacher of the Apostle Paul. So Apostle Paul definitely knew this, and he incorporates a number of these insights into his letters and his epistles. And so I'm just going to go through and share some of these things, and let me get this paper here. But I want you to pay attention, because one of these will probably describe you. Hillel was an absolute genius. He was a brilliant man and a very likable person as well. The Talmud records many controversies between Hillel and Shammai. And Hillel was a very happy person. He was just real open, outgoing, good teacher. Shammai was not quite as happy. He wasn't quite as good a teacher. Very strict, though. And Hillel believed in extending grace and blessing and Torah to the Gentiles. Shammai, no Gentiles. And whenever you read about Hillel and Shammai, almost always Hillel's decision on a matter was the one that stood. Because something about Hillel had a deeper insight into God's character and nature than Shammai ever had. And so Hillel begins to describe different kinds of people. And the Hebrew words he chooses to describe these are very, very insightful. They're very important. It opens up with, an uncultivated man will never fear sin. In Hebrew, it says a lot more. There's only four words in Hebrew. Ein bor yara kate. A bor, an uncultivated man. What does this word bor mean? I'm going to read you a few passages from this book. So I want you to know I'm not stealing from, what's the word? Plagiarizing? No, not plagiarizing from him. What is a bor? Well, the word bor is used in several Jewish writings to describe a kind of field, a sadeh bor. A sadeh bor is a field that is allowed to lie fallow. No effort is made to develop or indeed to discover the potential that lies within it or to find the uses to which this property might be put. carried over into the human sphere, it would portray one who has no interest in finding out what is going on inside himself. One who does not care to learn of those talents and abilities that are waiting to burst into the open and shape a creative life. The boar is willing to drift in a flat, conventional existence, unchallenged and therefore uninspired by the unique spark of his unique personality. Such a one can never be a yerekat, a fearer of sin. The boor is one who he's never examined his own life. He's never really thought, what am I made up of? Who am I? He's the kind of person who I say, I'm just human. I can't help it. I'm just human. It's just the way I am. That's the boar talking. Don't ever, any of you ever say, I never want to hear, unless you want to see my wrath, I never want to hear you say, that's just the way I am. You're human, for Pete's sake. You can change yourself. Dogs and cats and fish can't. You can. You can change yourself. In fact, you're required to. But then the word for sin, the word kate, there are several words in Hebrew for sin. But this particular word means to miss the mark. It means that you may be trying and aiming, but you miss it. I always think of the passage in Judges where it talks about the left-handed men who could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not kate, not miss, not sin. Okay? What exactly is yerekate, fear of sin? Kate is sin committed inadvertently, in contrast to Om or Pasha, which describe transgressions committed intentionally. The root kate apparently describes a going astray, a deviation from the logical and the expected, an undirected wandering that will never lead to the hoped-for goal. Now listen to this. The boor can never be a yerekate. He is one who has never bothered to get to know himself, who has never attempted to release the creative energies of which he might be capable. He is clearly uninterested in the larger challenges which, when met purposely, could put his life to music. This is the kind of person, and there are some believers, not many, but there are some believers I've met who are boors. They don't really care what the Bible says. They're going to do kind of what they think is good and pretty much avoid what they think is bad. And, it's just who I am. I'm just human. And then they read a commandment that is blatant and black and white. Don't eat pork. Don't eat shrimp. We're under grace. Who cares? It's no big deal. It's just food. And, everybody else knows does it. They just don't care. They can never fear missing the mark because they just don't really care. They just want to kind of slouch through life. Just get through it the least pain possible. The boar can never fear sin. But then it goes on. It says an Am Haaretz will never be a Hasid. Hasid, you necessarily get the word Hasidic. The Hasidic Jews, pious. Now get the word of the black coat of Jews out of your minds. And look at the pure meaning of the word. It means pious, one who's truly observant, who truly tries to hit the mark, who's very concerned about hitting it. But it says, Velo Am Haaretz Chasia. Velo Am Haaretz means a people of the land. Now why does Hillel use people, instead of a person, Ish Haaretz? It doesn't say a person of the land. Am Haaretz refers to the nincompoop. The guy out there just has who's grubbing around in the dirt, just working and has no refinement whatsoever. But why does he use the plural? Why is he using the word people? He's a people of the land. Listen to what Eisman has to say about this. It's brilliant. Why should one person be described as an Am, a people? Because that is exactly what he is. Look at him and you see only the entire mass of anonymous humanity. He's just a clone. He's just like everybody else, going with the flow, doesn't want to stick out, doesn't want to go against the grain, let's just do what everybody else is doing. That's an Am Haaretz. Eisman brings out a good point. says, when God created the trees, he just said, let the earth bring forth trees. And bunches of trees come up. Let the earth bring forth birds. A bunch of birds come up. A bunch of fish come up. A bunch of animals come up. But comes a man, he makes what? Hand makes him. Breathes into his nostrils the neshama of life. Individual, distinct. Get the picture? And when God says, let us make man in our image, there are different interpretations of what the us means. One of them is that God is speaking to the earth. And God is saying, let us, you, the earth, and me, God, make man. You contribute the body, I'll contribute the soul. And so man is where the two come together. But the Am Ha'aretz, the man of the earth, of the land, all he cares about is the animal part. He doesn't lift his head to think of the spiritual part. Kind of reminds you of the overhead we looked at a minute ago. He's got his nose down here with the insects instead of lifting up to the high priest. You see? He searches out the things of the earth, but not the things of God. Adam was created individually. And God requires that we become an individual. Only when you become fully you, do you become truly observant and pious. When you just try to be like other observant people and other pious people, you miss the mark. You can only become truly spiritually mature by you having your relationship with God, an intimate relationship with Him, not by imitating others who do. You understand that? You must have a living connection with Him. You as sheep should be followers of the shepherd, not followers of other sheep. One of the things I love about, and I don't know how it works, it's an oxymoron or whatever word it is I'm supposed to be using there, but pretend I'm using the right one, is that you would think that the more we all obey the Torah and obey the commandments, the more alike we become. And you know what? We do. And yet something else happens. The more we all try to obey the commandments and obey God and build His word in our life, the more unique and individual we become. Go figure. I don't get it. But it happens. I find the Am Ha'aretz of the world, and I find the boors of the world very boring. They're all alike. They're all alike. They all follow the same fads. They all talk about the same things. They all wear the same clothes. They listen to the same music. It's boring, 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 boring. I find people, the more they draw close to God, the longer they live in His presence and strive to serve Him and please Him and obey Him, the more of a unique individual become, more fascinating they become to me. And I look over this motley crew. You're all pretty individual. You must be doing pretty well. And that's what I love about this. Because every one of you, the more you grow, as I've known you over the years, as I've seen your life come into obedience to the Torah, I've watched you become more of an individual. You blossom. And you bear a unique fruit that's unique to you. When I was teaching the Bible class here a week ago, I don't know how we got on it, but we started talking about reward, about works and reward. And you know, these young men, bless their hearts, they want to live righteous lives before God. They want to live obedient lives. And you can tell from the discussion that they're all thinking, well, hopefully I'll get some kind of reward, but it probably won't be much because I'm no Billy Graham. And so I shared with them, I said, let's get something straight. Billy Graham was called to be a Billy Graham. And you can take any spiritual hero of yours who would just fill in the blank. I use Billy Graham because everybody knows who he is. He's a good guy. But he was called to be Billy Graham. And so he's going to be rewarded based on how much he was Billy Graham. But you have been called to be you. And God has equipped you to be you. And God has given you everything you need and the time to do it in to accomplish your purpose in life on this earth. You'll be rewarded according to that. And guess what? You may be a custodian in a junior high school getting paid minimum wage and have a greater reward than Billy Graham because you fulfilled your destiny more fully and completely than he fulfilled his. It's not how many points you score by how many souls you win to God. It's how much you were you. Don't try to be somebody else. Learn from other people. Emulate good character qualities. But my goodness, don't be an Am Ha'aretz, a man of the earth. Be but you are a unique child of God. You know, after all the millions of people have been born, when it came time for you to be born, God did not run out of ideas. And they go, oh, well, I guess I need to make another one of these. Oh, yeah, here they are. He still has plenty of ideas, and every one of you is a unique idea, different from every other one. You are God's idea. Find out what his plan for you is. And it actually, it's his job to show you. Just seek his face. Live your life fully, embrace it, and be you in obedience to Torah. Because the more you submit your life to Torah, somehow, I don't understand it, you become more unique, not less. Oh, let's move on. One who is bashful will never learn. You know, for 30 years I taught public school and I prayed that all my class would be bashful. Lord, make them more bashful. They didn't know the word. But it says the one who is bashful will never learn. What does this mean? The word here used here for bashful is the word bush. Velo habusha lamed. And not the bashful will learn. What is bush? It's used a few times in Scripture, and it's used in other places outside of Scripture. Let me give you a few passages where it is used. In Exodus 32:1, it says, the people saw that Moses delayed. That word delayed is the verb form of bush, in descending from the mountain. Psalm 119:116. Do not, David's praying, he says, do not cause me bush concerning my hopes. In other words, do not destroy my hopes, do not embarrass me of my hopes, do not dash my hopes. The word bush, which usually means very withdrawn, really means someone who's not necessarily shameful. It's often translated as shame, but it means one whose expectations are frustrated. One whose expectations are frustrated. And Eisman writes about this. He says, feelings of shame or shyness are, at the end of the day, no more than doubts about one's adequacy. Let me read that again. Feelings of shame or shyness are, at the end of the day, no more than doubts about one's adequacy. We feel shy or diffident when we are convinced that we cannot live up to the expectations that others may have of us, or indeed, that we may have of ourselves. In other words, if you feel deep in your soul, I am inadequate to the task, I can never measure up, I can never do what God expects of me, guess what? You'll never truly learn. You're saying, God, you gave me a job to do, but you didn't equip me. You've given me the impossible to do. If you're given something impossible to do, why even try? This is what just frustrates me to death when I hear some theologians say, the purpose of the Torah was this. God gave the Jews the Torah to prove to them that they could not keep it. I'm sorry, folks, that's just stupid. God has given you the Torah, and he has given you the ability to keep it. And his commandments are not burdensome, John tells us. And they're not far away. They're near your lips. They're not difficult. Paul says he kept it perfectly. We can do it. But when you believe, I can't learn, I can't improve, I can't get better, well, guess what? You'll never learn. Learn to stand up on your own hind legs and move forward with the Lord. He's got something wonderful for you. Go back and reread Proverbs chapter 3, that passage we read. About the silver and the gold, about the precious stones. God's got such wonderful things in store for you, but you've got to get ahead and walk. Now, God will carry you when you can't walk, but he sure as heck won't, I probably should use heck. I used it anyways. He sure as heck won't help you if you can. Wars cannot be waged by the timid, and only the bold can learn creatively. Learning must be a journey of discovery, and self-doubters make indifferent explorers. The shy student will find it hard to learn because questions must be asked and clarification sought. This is the corroding and eroding self-doubt that craves the safety of the familiar. You know, the Torah movement is not for cowards, because it's going to require you to be different from all those around you. And even those who have nothing to do with church and nothing to do with religion, they're going to look at you and say, you're not even going to church. You're even weirder than the ones who go to church on Sunday. It's not for the bashful. It's not for the shy. It's not for the fearful. And it says, the boosh will be afraid to undertake any but the most banal and uninspired measure. The application of true wisdom is not for the faint of heart. And then it says, the one who is overly sensitive will never teach. Now in Hebrew, the word for learn and the word for teach come from the same root, the word lamed. And you can even see it up here, the word lamed. There's lamed, mem, dalet. And then here's the word for teach, which is mem, lamed, mem, dalet. So you see the same word here and here. And God is trying to teach us something here. In other words, the teacher must forever be a student. And the moment you quit learning, that moment you lose your excitement about teaching. You know, Ben, you could tell this evening when he was sharing, he was excited. He was animated. Why were you animated, Ben? Because you're learning. You're excited to share what you learned. You even said as much this evening. And you know, I'm sharing with you things I just learned this last week. It's exciting to me to share with you what I've discovered or plagiarized. So, you know, the day I quit being a student, I'm just going to pass this over to somebody else. I might as well quit sitting up here trying to tell you anything. But the one who is overly sensitive will never teach. Now, what does this mean, overly sensitive? Eisman calls this person the stickler. He says the consensus among the commentators is that the kapdan, that's the word for overly sensitive. It's a very unusual word, the kapdan. That the kapdan is impatient and quick to anger. How can we possibly expect a student to pay attention to one who hates them? A teacher was like a fiery furnace scattering sparks. Sounds like my first year teaching. Arrows and death with his foul temper. The words of the wise are heard best when spoken softly. Now, he says, but this word here, he says we're not necessarily dealing with a vicious anger that seeks only to wound, but with an exaggerated sensitivity that finds it hard to deal with deviations from the norm, or the assumed norm. Kafad appears to describe a finicky insistence that everything should be just so. This is the gnat strainer. The gnat strainer can never be a truly inspiring teacher because they're concerned only with straining gnats, details, little things. The little things are important. But the one who remains a student sees the big picture, and there's a zealousness, there's a foundation, and a joy in what they do. Eisman discusses Shammai and Hillel. It says, to Shammai, truth was truth, and the patently ridiculous demands which the would-be proselytes made could find no sympathy. Hillel was willing to take the broader view. He was able to see from where they came and where, treated with sympathy and understanding, they could be headed. He was able to scale down the truth temporarily for the greater truth that lay just beyond the moment. The Gemara praises Hillel's, is what's called anuva, his ability to make himself small and humble himself and make things gentle for the ones who learn. His successes demonstrated that he was the better teacher. Are you short-tempered? Are you critical of your students? Do you pick them to death for every little detail? Are you always trying to catch them doing something wrong instead of catching them doing things right? Then you're failing as a teacher. One is overly sensitive, impatient, who's the stickler, always looking for the details. I remember my piano teacher. She had these, she always, her pencils never worn down. They're always a foot long. And hit a wrong note, smack, right on the knuckles. You know, and she was, I don't know. Anyways, I guess I learned something from her, but I just remember how she'd be gentle for, but about the third time I hit the wrong note, kapow, down came the big yellow number two pencil on my knuckle. Then it says that he who is very involved in business will never attain wisdom. Now what's interesting about this is that the uncultivated man, this is a noun, this is a thing. And am ha'aretz, referring to a person, a kind of person. One who is bashful, one who is overly sensitive. But here's a verb, one who is very involved, one who's doing this. And something that Eisen points out, he says, Hillel was so brilliant here. Because now this is referring to someone who is cultivated. Someone who may be very pious. Someone who is adequate and prepared for a challenge. Someone who is gentle. Someone who is not overly sensitive, not a stickler. He has all the four qualities that the first four should have, but don't. But what has he done with them? Instead of applying them to his pursuit of God, he's applied them to his pursuit of wealth. He's got all the characteristics, but where is he pointing them to? Now notice the word, very involved. Now everyone should be involved in business. As we read earlier, Torah study with an occupation keeps you from sin. And if you're studying Torah, you need to be working with your hands. Yeshua was a teacher and a Torah scholar and a carpenter. Paul was a tent maker and a scholar. John was a fisherman and a net mender, and and he was also a disciple. They all had jobs. David, the shepherd, and he was also the sweet singer of Israel and the king. He had occupations. But the word here used for very involved in business means the one who always likes to acquire. And generally, this is translated as business. But you know what? It really doesn't have a whole lot to do with business either. It means the person who learns not for the sake of learning, but for accumulating knowledge that is more than his neighbor's. You catch what I'm saying? He's not learning for the love of learning. He's not learning for the glory of God. He's not learning for the betterment of his own life so he can be a brighter light and a wiser man. He's learning so he can accumulate more knowledge than Ben has. More knowledge than Ken has. So next time we play Bible trivia, I'll just wipe him off the board. So the motives for learning are wrong. He's overly involved in accumulating knowledge rather just in learning. Do you know what I'm talking about? Let's see. What does Eisman say? One interested in quantity diminishes his knowledge, but if he is willing to go step by step, he will accomplish much. Isn't that good? Should I read that again? One interested in quantity diminishes his knowledge, but if he is willing to go step by step, it's the process of learning that he loves. He will accomplish much. By the way, that's not Eisman. That's Proverbs 13:11. Interesting, isn't it? It says we ignore the We ignore the value of the detail because of our infatuation with comprehensive knowledge at our peril. He says this person sees only the bottom line. The penny matters only to the extent that it contributes to the whole. He wants knowledge and lots of it, by the pile, by the bucket load, so he just has more than anybody else. So his learning is not God-centered, it's competition-centered, competing with his brothers and sisters. And then we have the final one. This is what Hillel has been aiming at all along. In the absence of a true man, strive to be a man. The way the Hebrew puts it is a little bit better. In the place where there is no man, try to be a man. When you're in a place where everyone is a bore, strive not to be. And any place in your life where you have the temptation to be a bore, or a namaha or a ritz, strive to be a man. Wherever you tend to be bashful and feel I'm just inadequate to learn and to live, strive to be a man. Now, this isn't meant to be sexist language. It means to be a full human being, to be all that God has created you and equipped you to be. And don't settle for anything less. And when you're around people who are just kind of getting their spiritual sword fighting to display all their biblical knowledge, strive to be a man who's wise, because kokuma, wisdom, is better than having a head full of facts. I'm reminded of the story, I can't remember which sage it was, and I'll close with this. There was a guy who attended his yeshiva, and he's always studying. Memorizing everything, studying everything, reading, just packing it in. And then one day, the rabbi hears that this man has died. And the students say, are you going to so-and-so's funeral? And he says, no, I'm not going. I said, you're not going? Why aren't you going? He said, all we've lost is a donkey loaded with books. We haven't lost a scholar. A donkey loaded with books. Now, there's an image for you. If a donkey is carrying a load of books, Encyclopedia Britannica, does it make the donkey smart? Does it make the donkey wise? Does it make him educated? Let's say the donkey is carrying the Torah, the Tanakh, and all of the sacred writings and the books and all the wisdom of the ages on his back. Is the donkey any wiser because he's carrying this burden of books? We know every one of us can be like a donkey with a sack of books in their head and not have true wisdom. You know, this Torah portion, I started off by talking about how there's confusion. There's confusion. People are getting confused. What do we do? What's happening here? What's going on? And in every case, we must have wisdom, because kokuma, wisdom, will tell you what to do and give you guidance when there's no precedent for something. It'll give you guidance when there's no precedent. It'll give you information on the hoof, so to speak. So seek true wisdom from God. It's wealth, it's protection, and it's greater than anything you could possibly desire. And you know, I think that's what this Torah portion of Shemini is really about, wisdom. As we see people failing, we see things falling to pieces, and kokma, wisdom, and it's right at the heart of the Bible. Remember the two middle words of the Bible, derosh, derosh. Diligently seek, diligently search. Okay, we're on an adventure, folks. We're on the greatest adventure that you could possibly ever embark upon. And that's the adventure of you becoming fully you in the time you've got. It's a race. Grow up to full stature. Become mighty in spirit. Become a man and a woman of wisdom. Become a person who reflects God's glory, his love, his kindness. You got one lifetime to get it right. And since I started, you got about 1 hour and 10 minutes less than you did before to get it right. So time is passing. So let's keep on the adventure. Keep walking, keep moving. Okay? That's my challenge to myself, and that's my challenge to you. Let's grow up to full stature. For the sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and close, and probably up here we can yak and ask questions and stay up here. If people want to talk, we'll just kind of meet over here. If you have questions or comments, just come up here to the front after Havdalah, and we'll just talk more, okay? Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your patience with us. Lord, you're so long-suffering. And Lord, when we get impatient with our children, how much more must you be tempted to be impatient with us? Because many times they display more wisdom than we do. So Father, be patient a while longer and draw us along. You've equipped us with so much. And Lord, since you've given us much, we know that much is expected of us. So Father, I pray you strengthen our wills. to be brave and courageous, to step apart from the crowd, to follow you when no one else does, to lead a life that is holy, that is obedient, that is courageous, that is light, that is everything that Yeshua was. Lord, I pray that the image of Messiah might be seen in us. And Lord, that your word would never be to us just cold stone, but it might be white hot light, that we might actually see the kavod Adonai, the glory of God. Lord, I pray our lives would not just be a rule book. How boring is that? But Father, it'd be an orderly life. That's what the world needs. That's what the world is attracted to. That's what the world wants to see and needs to see so much. That's what we need to be, because that is what you are. So Father, until the world to come comes, may the world to come be demonstrated in our everyday lives. We ask this in the name of Yeshua. Amen.